What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Just one thin imaginary line at the 45th parallel marks the distinction between two countries, Canada and the United States. So close in proximity, but so different in many aspects, including their political systems. And while the American presidential race seems like it's been going on for 50 months, the federal election in Canada is just 50 days long. And that seems like far too many days to Canadians, because in the good old days, it used to be even shorter. Canadians also don't vote for a president or, in their case, a prime minister. And campaign financing is another aspect that you'll find quaint and might even be envious of. Today, we're going to learn about the federal election, which will be held on Monday, October 21st. We'll also learn about the Canadian political system, its politics, and the political races that will shape the nation for the next 4 years. And in a bit, we'll zero in on what's happening during this campaign with our number one trading partner, Quebec. Here to get us started on the Canadian civics lesson is Jeff Ayers. He's a political science professor at St. Michael's College and an expert on Canadian politics. Jeff, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Very happy to be here.
Jeff Ayers, and with apologies to our Canadian listeners and those who understand the Canadian political system fully, I do want to start by understanding the differences between that system and the American system. So first of all, when a Canadian goes to the poll on October 21st, what will be on the ballot they receive?
Well, what will be on the ballot they receive is a list of candidates for their particular riding. So they call them ridings in Canada, similar to our congressional districts. Mm-hmm. There's 338 ridings across the country. And so if you're a Canadian, no matter where you are across Canada, you're only voting for candidates in your riding. So presumably, it's not clear yet if all of the six main parties will have candidates across the country, but presumably they'll be most of those parties will be represented on your ballot. So you'll have somebody from your riding that you're voting for.
But that's it.
That's it. One of the huge differences that I, having taught Canadian politics for two decades at St. Mike's, and my students are always fascinated that Canadians don't vote for the prime minister, right? They don't vote. You're across the country. Only one group of people in one riding in Montreal are going to have Justin Trudeau on the ballot. So you're voting for a member of parliament. That person's going in to be part of a party, part of the caucus in the House of Commons.
And they also have an upper house or a Senate. Do they get to vote for those representatives?
No, the Senate is – the Canadian Senate is unelected. And, for decades, really, there's been an ongoing debate about whether that should be reformed, should it be abolished. So at this point – it remains actually kind of an anomaly in Western liberal democracies as an unelected upper body.
Wow. And then as far as the prime minister, who they don't vote for, in effect, they are in a way. Explain that.
Right. They are in a way because the prime minister, Justin Trudeau, the leader of the Liberal Party, the assumption is that obviously if the Liberals retain their majority or even if they are returned with a minority, he will remain the prime minister. What Canadians have to, and I'm sure what they think about is, well, who's leading the party? So it's the leader of the party that would become prime minister. So if the Conservative Party, and it's absolutely possible, the polls mm-hmm. are so tight, if the Conservative Party were to get the plurality of the votes in the House of Commons on the 21st, then Andrew Scheer would become who's the leader of the Conservative Party, would become prime minister. So you're not voting directly in your riding for the prime minister, but if you're relatively politically astute, you have a sense of who would become prime minister.
Now, you mentioned right now the Liberals do have a majority. It is possible because of early polling that whichever party does then choose the prime minister might not have a majority, which would be 170 of the 338 seats in Parliament in Ottawa. So let's talk about that when there is no clear majority. What does occur in Parliament?
So that's another interesting – just the idea of what does it mean to have a minority government. And it's not that unusual. In fact, about 25% of Canadian governments in the last 50 plus years, 56 years or so, have been minority governments. And the way that would work is for the most part, the party that got the most votes, it still wouldn't be a majority of the vote, but that got the most votes would still, that their leader would become the prime minister. But as a minority, it means you simply don't have the majority of the seats in the House of Commons. So you're going to have to rely on other parties to govern. And there's different traditions. There's different ways in which you can do that. It's in Canada over the last several minority governments, and there were two under Stephen Harper, the previous Conservative prime minister. It's more ad hoc. You're kind of tacitly negotiating with some of the opposition parties based on certain issues. What you don't have, and I actually think this is one of the most interesting things in comparison with Europe, Canada doesn't have a tradition of coalitions, formal coalitions. If they had that, you might have a much more formal, stable, minority government. In this instance, since it's more ad hoc, minority governments tend not to last more than 2 years, whereas a normal majority government is a 4-year term.
Well, in the past, I believe Parliament could be dissolved and an election called for under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. Correct? Is that still the case in Canada, or have they now adopted a set election date every 4 years?
So it's both, actually. They have adopted a set election date. So it's the third Monday in October after the previous federal election, which is why it's this. I don't know how 4 years went by so fast in 2015, but it's October 21st. 2019 is the next federal election. But that doesn't stop. I mean, hypothetically, a year ago, Justin Trudeau could have gone to the governor general and asked for the House to be dissolved and a new election could have conceivably been called. There wouldn't be a vote of no confidence because the Liberals have a majority. In a minority government situation, there could be a vote of no confidence, or the government could lose on a certain issue and the government could fall.
Is Election Day a national holiday in Canada?
It's not a national holiday. I think there are certain laws in place that require employers to allow their employees a 3-hour time frame roughly to get to the polling place, but it's not a national holiday.
Interesting. Let's discuss the length of Canadian elections, 50 days, and I believe that was a massive increase from elections gone by. We've been at 50 at least a couple now. Why so short in the first place?
Why so short? I mean, part of it is a tradition. When the House is dissolved, there just has been a tradition of having much, much shorter electoral campaigns. I mean, right now there's a law in place that it has to be no less than 36 days, and it can be no longer than 50 days. And I think there must be a number of different reasons. I think part of it is tradition. Part of it is the far less money is expended on the campaigns, far less. I think it was less than $450 million was in total spent on the federal election in Canadian dollars in the 2015 election. Think about that. I think there's a certain political cultural expectation. You said it in your intro that I think the average Canadian oftentimes thinks that's already too long.
Right.
And whereas we are, in the United States, wrapped up in already pre-Iowa caucus, the presidential campaign. So I think it's a mix of tradition, political culture, less money available, for the campaign and so forth.
And I guess without a set date sometimes to the end of a parliament, you want to have an election that's fairly quick and be able to house the parliament again quickly.
Right. So the date's set. I mean, those every 4-year dates are now set following. So since we had a federal election back in October of 2015, there'll be another one following 4 years again, unless there's a dissolution of the parliament. But I think you're right. I think part of it is just it's phenomenal how fast the next government is seated. They'll be sworn in, I would imagine, by the governor general a week after the election. And that's it. The government's in place.
Incredible.
Unless there's a minority government, and there's a very good chance there'll be a minority government, and then there'll be a little bit more political jockeying for is the party that has the most seats Are they going to get – do they have the confidence of the House? Do they have enough parties, other parties supporting them that they can govern?
September 10th started this particular election. I mean, what happens if my party, the Rick Party, decided on September 8th or last August to start campaigning? Is there any problem with that, or is it just a Canadian way of knowing that you don't put up an ad, a poster until September 10th?
Yeah, well, yes. First of all, there actually are legal prohibitions on campaigning, on expenses for campaigning based prior to the election being called versus afterwards. So there are different amounts that you can spend. I think part of it has to do, again, by the tradition of one, you wait until parliament's been dissolved until you engage in a formal campaign. Let me just add that during the course of the when parliament is sitting, one of the traditions or arguments is that the House of Commons, in particular, question period, which is another really something that clearly distinguishes the Canadian political system from our own, that question period is in effect kind of an ongoing electoral process. There's kind of an almost daily contest going on where the opposition is showing through their questions their how they stand on certain issues. They can critique the government. So there's kind of a shadow electoral campaign going on until the formal one is called.
Does financing of elections differ from what happens here in the United States?
Absolutely.
I mean, you mentioned the whole thing only cost $450 million Canadian, which is incredible. But how are these campaigns financed compared to what we see in the U.S.?
So they're just – it's completely different. There's two or three main ways in which a electoral campaign is funded. One is through individual contributions, and the most recent changes to campaign financing are that the individual contribution was capped at $1,500, but it was and then going to go up every $25 every year. But one of the most significant differences is that corporations and labor unions are forbidden from donating, contributing to political campaigns, which is a huge difference. And then there was for a while, about 15 years or so, maybe not quite 15 years, 10 years or so, the political parties were actually given financing or they were assisted in their campaigns with per vote subsidy. That's actually ended now. And now there's a significant portion beyond individual contributions of your of party funding during elections is through an electoral expense reimbursement. So the more your party spends, the more it gets back. You're subsidized 50% of your national campaign expenses if you get 2% of the vote or 5%. 2% nationally or 5% in a riding, and your party's riding organization, just like our Democratic or Republican Party district organizations, they're reimbursed 60% of all expenses incurred in ridings when they obtain at least 10% of the vote. So there's some kind of tricky specifics, but there's some significant still public financing involved compared. And again, notice the prohibitions against corporate and labor donations is a significant difference.
I wonder how this will impact the Rhino Party going forward. We did hear from Breadbox on Facebook who wrote, I'm a Canadian. By law, everyone who is eligible to vote must have 3 consecutive hours to cast their vote on election day. If your work hours do not allow for 3 consecutive hours to vote, your employer must give you time off. So briefly, Jeff Ayers, give us an idea of the major parties vying for seats in this election.
Right. The major parties are the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party. So those are the two to keep an eye on. One of those two parties will form the next government. And the polls are very, very tight. One major poll yesterday shows the Conservatives up by a couple points. Another poll today shows the Liberals up by a couple points. So that's the real the contest for whose party will form the government and have a prime minister. But the other parties are really interesting. I mean, so you have the NDP, you have the New Democratic Party that's been around for several decades, led by Jagmeet Singh. He's a very interesting politician originally from Ontario. He has a seat now out in BC. The NDP has seen a significant loss in support and seats over the last several years from their real triumph there when they did very, very well in Quebec. The NDP has around, looking at the polls, 12% to 15% support. Then you have the interesting the Green Party led by Elizabeth May, and there are indications that the Green Party could do quite well. They when at the time of dissolution there were only two Green Party seats. You need 12 seats to have official representation in the House. I doubt the Greens would get above 12, but they could seriously impact. They could negatively impact both the NDP and possibly the Liberals. Then there's the Bloc, so the Bloc Québécois, which I think is actually very important to talk about because the Bloc seem to have faded away, but they may make a comeback. I think the Bloc is the party to watch in terms of the impact they will have on the Liberal Party's ability to win seats in Quebec that could predict whether they get a majority. And then there's the very small People's Party of
which
Canada,
is brand new.
Brand new, led by Bernier, which is a kind of a, I would say, a right-wing populist party, very small, that still may impact a couple key ridings in Quebec.
I'm Rick Zingari, and this is Vermont Edition. Canada goes to the polls on October 21st for their federal election, and today we're taking a look at what issues are most important to voters there and getting a sense of how the makeup of Parliament might change. Joining us now as we take a closer look at what's happening in the province of Quebec is Jonathan Monpetit. He's the Quebec political correspondent for CBC Montreal. Jonathan, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much.
Jonathan, looking at the last three Quebec delegations in Parliament, the makeup has changed radically each time. Why is that?
Well, I think Quebec is undergoing an important sociological moment. For a long time, the province, politics in the province had been dominated by the federalist-sovereigntist divide between people who believe Quebec's future was within Canada and people who believed the province should separate and form a form of an autonomous unit. We've seen the progressive decline of the sovereigntist option over the last 10 or 15 years or so, and as the popularity is waning for sovereignty, other political groups have kind of come in to fill that vacuum. And we saw initially that was the NDP, the left-leaning party that Jeff talked about earlier, in 2011, a huge delegation surprised everybody from Quebec. Last election, it was the Liberal Party, Federalist centrist party, and what will happen this time around, nobody really knows, but we are seeing signs that a party that had been associated with the sovereigntist movement, the Bloc Québécois, is doing well in the polls, although I think it's important to point out that they're really playing down the sovereigntist dimension of their platform and really presenting themselves as Quebec nationalists as opposed to Quebec sovereigntists.
And the Bloc only runs candidates within Quebec, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. So what are voters in Quebec most concerned about right now?
Well, the latest polling suggests that the environment is one of the big concerns in the province, and Quebecers tend to care about the environment more than other Canadian voters. One of the specific issues is whether or not Quebec should allow a pipeline, a cross-Canada pipeline, to be built through its territory. So the Conservative Party, which has a base in Western Canada, especially Alberta, where Canada's oil industry is located, they support this pipeline, a way to transport Western oil to markets in Eastern Canada and for export around the world. Now, in order to build that pipeline, though, it would have to go through Quebec. That is a very unpopular proposal. And so you're seeing a lot of the other parties are kind of reminding Quebec voters that the Conservative Party wants to go ahead this project, and that they're Liberals, the NDP, and the Bloc Québécois are all opposed to it. And the Bloc Québécois, interestingly, frames this in a nationalist way and saying, Quebec should have the right to say no to pipelines crossing into its territory, even though that is a federal jurisdiction, and Quebec doesn't really, technically, according to the Constitution, have that power to say no.
Gotcha. Quebec, after years of debate, though, back and forth, has passed a secularism law. Explain briefly what that is and then how party leaders are addressing it when they come to campaign in Quebec.
Okay, so the secularism law bans authority figures in the province from wearing religious symbols at work. Now, authority figures under the law is defined as public school teachers, government lawyers, police officers, judges, prison guards, and so none of these people are allowed to wear religious symbols such as hijabs or kippahs or turbans while at work. Now, it's been very controversial. Whether or not the law is constitutional or not, but she pointed out, the law does enjoy a lot of popular support in the province. And so, interestingly, the provinces, the parties have to kind of negotiate the popularity of the law. So while the law has raised a lot of concerns outside of Quebec, it remains popular inside of the province. And so when parties are campaigning here, they have to kind of walk a fine line between their own opposition to the law and its support in the province.
Jeff Ayers, the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has had a couple of scandals to deal with. SNC-Lavalin, and this most recent one is the blackface, brownface issues. Briefly, tell us what they are about.
SNC-Lavalin, that was a political scandal where Justin Trudeau was seen as interfering politically in the justice system involving a large Quebec company, SNC-Lavalin, and he was viewed as having improperly put pressure on the then Minister of Justice and Attorney General Jody Wilson-Raybould. He and others, I'm sure, in his party, the concern was the damage that could be inflicted on this company in an ongoing criminal prosecution, and Trudeau was interested in there being a deferred prosecution agreement, and so this caused. This came out. Raybould resigned as she was shuffled into a different portfolio, but it just continued to unfold and became more and more controversial. And ultimately, the ethics commissioner in the last 6 months or so in Canada did rule that Trudeau had contravened a conflict of interest act. But they're actually, it's unclear what the real repercussions are. In fact, the conservative leader, Andrew Scheer, has said if he is elected, if his party forms a government, he wants to reopen this and significantly investigate what went on, the political interference in the justice system. You know, the blackface, brownface issue is certainly surprising, disappointing, I think, to many people, Canadians as well as people around the world. You know, Trudeau has had this image of being this supporter of multiculturalism and cultural pluralism as Canada's kind of a leading light in that sense. I think, interestingly enough, when you look at the polls, I looked at the tracking polls over the last week. It looks like that, when it came out a week or so ago, did have an initial impact. But the majority of Canadians don't seem overly concerned, or it doesn't seem to be overly affecting their opinions of the race. Certainly a significant percentage accepted his apology and want to move on. I think I've seen about a quarter felt that they were especially deeply offended or concerned about it, but a significant percentage of those people were conservatives anyway. So it actually doesn't seem to have had a significant impact. And again, you asked what it was. This was just Trudeau admitting that there were several times earlier in his youth, 20 years or so ago, when in different instances he wore blackface.
Jonathan Monpetit, what are you hearing from the voters in Quebec about these two controversies?
Well, it's very interesting. There tends to be different reactions to both of them. Jeff mentioned the SNC scandals. This really cost the Liberals a lot of support in the rest of the country. SNC-Lavalin, though, is a Quebec corporation. It's based in Montreal. And the issue in Quebec was less about the ethics violation, was less about the interference in the justice system, and it was more about protecting Quebec jobs and protecting the head office being in Montreal, and the Quebec government really didn't want to see the company be tried on these corruption and bribery charges. And so Trudeau's position on the issue, which was, hey, look, I was just trying to protect Quebec jobs, resonated with Quebecers, I think, or at least to the extent that they didn't really feel the same level of indignation that a lot of other Canadians felt at the scandal. And when it came to blackface, you know, Jeff hinted that, you know, we're not seeing much movement in the polls. There was, though, a difference, I think, in how columnists reacted outside of Quebec and inside Quebec. Outside of Quebec, you know, just about every columnist in the country tore a strip off Trudeau, and you know, how could he do this? This is a moral outrage, and it provoked a really interesting conversation about systemic racism in Canada. Within Quebec, though, columnists for the most part shrugged and said, well, what's the big deal? It happened 20 years ago. Trudeau's foolish, and of course, he shows the hypocrisy of multiculturalism. But for the most part, it didn't really interest Quebec columnists as an issue worth spending a lot of time on.
We had this email from Dennis in Burlington, and he asks, is Black Quebecois a factor? Does Scheer have anything going in Quebec? So, Jonathan, before I let you go, what is the picture right now? What are we seeing? Will the Liberals return with the big numbers they got? Will that be chipped away by the Conservatives, Bloc Québécois, NDP? What do you see right now going on?
It's a really interesting question. So right now, the Liberals are ahead in Quebec, about 15-point lead over the Conservatives and the Bloc Québécois. The Conservatives and the Bloc Québécois are now tied, and they're competing with each other for the Quebec nationalist vote, this kind of conservative sentiment in the province, and that's a kind of the B story, but a really interesting story. And this is where the election is playing out in Quebec. This is the kind of dynamic that we're seeing outside of Montreal and outside of Quebec City, in those smaller towns where, you know, the question is really who's best positioned to represent Quebec interests? Who's going to allow Quebecers to stand up to the federal government and to claim more powers? And that's the debate that we're seeing now in the province between the Conservatives and the Bloc Québécois.
Jonathan Mompetit is Quebec political correspondent for CBC Montreal. Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeff, let's look ahead to Monday, October 21st, that evening. What will be the big storyline?
Well, still unclear. Let's be fair. It's 3 weeks away. A lot can happen. A couple storylines will be. One is that Canada's very much a regional country. You're going to see very different regional outcomes. So right now, the Liberals, as Jonathan pointed out, are doing well in Quebec. They're still in the lead in Ontario, and they're doing well in the Maritimes. The Prairies, so Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, the Conservative Party is doing very well there. And then in British Columbia, this happens often, it's very, almost in a dead heat, the Liberals and the Conservatives. So you're going to see, you know, it'll be interesting to watch if you're watching, you'll see the results coming in. You'll start to see it across the country, and you'll probably see the Liberals doing reasonably well across the east into Quebec. But what you're going to really want to watch is Ontario and how well the Conservatives do in plucking off some of the current Liberal seats. And I'll say something that's kind of an interesting piece to this is watch where the leaders go over the next few weeks. So where the leaders are campaigning, there's right now it looks like the Conservative Party's on the offense. Scheer has been traveling to a number of ridings currently held by Liberals, whereas Trudeau, half and half, kind of visiting ridings that are currently Liberal and also visiting NDP ridings, trying to cut into the NDP. So I think that Ontario is going to be a very key the suburbs of Toronto is going to be very important. I think the Conservatives are going to do very well in the Prairies, and it has a lot to do with the pipeline issues, the environment, climate change, the carbon tax, and then we'll have to see what happens in BC.
And as we're speaking, we're using Liberal Cap L, Liberal Conservative Cap C as the party names.
Right.
So let's overlay, though, the kind of ideological map of where the right and the left are in Canada compared to the United States.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that. It's another distinguishing characteristic of Canada. So here's an interesting statistic. Back in the 2015 federal election, About 11 million Canadians voted for center-left parties. About 6 million Canadians voted to the right. And again, that goes back to what I – and so they, to answer your broader question, the Canadian electorate is broadly more center-left than the United States. So they have the Conservative Party, which is – arguably center right, but I would argue you would find many people in the Canadian Conservative Party, I think, at home in our Democratic Party, at least conservative Democrats. Then you have the Liberals, you have the NDP, you have the Green Party, you have the Bloc, and yes, the People's Party, but very tiny. Those major parties, the Liberals, the NDP, the Greens, and the Bloc, those are all more center left. What that raises that or comes back to that point I made earlier, which is that if Canada had a tradition of forming more formal coalitions, you would see far more center-left governments. I think it would be even more difficult to imagine a conservative government. So yeah, ideologically, Canadians tend to be more center-left. Part of that has to do with the fact that more Canadians live in cities than in the United States, and they tend to be a higher percentage of people living in urban areas tend to be more on the liberal end of the political spectrum. But that gets into a whole fascinating discussion about the differences historically between Canadian and Americans political cultural mm-hmm. sense.
How might this election alter the current relationship between Ottawa and Washington?
Interesting. So that to end potentially on that question, the United States looms huge in Canadian politics. It always has. We always have. We're Canada's leading ally, key trading partner. And it's always crucial for Canadian politicians, and certainly during electoral campaign or when you're in government, to not be seen as overtly friendly to the leadership of the United States. In this instance, it's easy to say that President Trump is widely despised across the majority of Canada. So the impact could be that if the Conservative Party were to form a minority government or even get a majority, it'll be an interesting challenge for them in their governing to not be seen as suddenly overtly embracing the Trump administration, which again, our own election coming up within the year. So I think that the Conservative Party has their challenges, as does the Liberal Party, should the Liberals get back in with a majority. What we should keep our eye on, NAFTA, that'll be a signature issue. The Liberals and Trudeau will campaign on jobs. The economy is doing quite well in Canada overall, and they're quite happy with the way in which NAFTA was renegotiated. But that actually the USMCA, as it's been renamed, hasn't been ratified yet. So we have to keep our eyes on that.
Jeff Ayers is a political science professor at St. Michael's College and an expert on Canadian politics. Jeff, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.